Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled, Should the Federal Government Be in the 5G Business? My name is Greg Walsh, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have joining us John Adam, General Counsel in the Office of Senator Marsha Blackburn, Kelly Cole, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at CTIA, George S. Ford, Chief Economist at the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies, and moderating is Lawrence J. Spiewak, President of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies and member of the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group Executive Committee. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Larry, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. As you just heard, today's topic is, should the federal government be in the 5G business? What motivated this teleforum is, I'm sure it's been in the news a lot, is that the Department of Defense recently issued a request for information about the possibility of constructing a new national 5G network on a very large block of very prime mid-band spectrum that's presently assigned to the Department of Defense. And access to the spectrum by commercial wireless services could be granted or is not needed for national security requirements through a dynamic spectrum sharing agreement arrangement. And there's been a lot of talk in the news, as I said before. Many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, as well as the FCC, have voiced opposition to this, yet we hear through news reports that some in the White House are in favor of this, even though President Trump has publicly opposed it. So what we were hoping today is sort of to go through this, find out exactly what is going on, explore some of the legal issues that are at stake, and also to talk about some of the economic policy implications. So we are joined, as you heard a moment ago, by a stellar group of people, a lot of experience in this business. So let's start with, I guess, the most basic question of what exactly is going on here. If you look at the DOD's RFI, it is only three pages. It is extremely vague and obtuse, yet to hear people, it sounds like the federal government is about to formally get into the broadband business. So I'd like to turn to Kelly and John, because those guys have got their thumbs on the pulse. And you know, what is going on here, really, with this proposal? And Kelly, I'll start with you.
Sure. And thanks, Larry. And thanks to the Federalist Society for putting this on. You know, this is an issue that, honestly, we've been talking about sort of quietly for the last 3.5 years. And you may remember it was about 3.5 years ago now that there was a memo that came out of the NSC over at the White House, the National Security Council, that sort of proposed this idea of a nationalized network. And the reason behind that at the time was the thought that if we wanted to beat China in the race to 5G, it was going to take the federal government getting involved. Back then, 3.5 years ago, this idea was, to your earlier point, absolutely panned by all sides of the government. We've seen all 5 FCC commissioners oppose it. 19 Republican senators, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, 43 right of center groups, including Americans for Tax Reform and Heritage. I mean, it's just been just universally denounced. And it's one of those issues that it would pop up and then it would go away again, and it would pop up and it go back away. And I think this RFI that we saw come out of the Department of Defense is the first time we've actually seen a concrete step towards DOD sort of nationalizing a 5G network for commercial purposes.
John, what are you hearing?
So So a lot of the same, you know, and again, thank you to Federal Society for putting this together and for having me on. We've noticed that the proposals that come about in this space tend to share similar language. So you kind of get a sense that these things are coming from the same place and they take different shapes. We've had a lot of the different proposals that have come through the NDAA process. You know, being on Commerce and Armed Services, you get a different viewpoint into what's actually going on. And we're just, we're optimistic that if we're unified, we can keep this nationalization idea off the table. But it's something that we do have to just come together and kind of agree that government working with the private sector is what yields the best solutions here. It's not government going about it on its own. And, you know, right now, it seems like a late proposal that just kind of came together at the very end. And we'll see what ends up happening with it. But I'm glad that it's gotten enough attention that we may be able to do something about it.
So again, just to sort of bring a little more clarity to the issue, this wouldn't be. I mean, the government contracts for its own networks all the time, and people do that. They've got private stuff. So I guess the model that we're talking about here is that. I think, and again, that's one because you can't discuss it unless we kind of at least know what we're talking about. Where, in other words, somebody would come in and say, "Hi, I will build this network," and essentially the DoD would, for all intents and purposes, give over its spectrum to this entity, which would build this new network, right? And then DoD would then use it. But in other words, when we're not using the spectrum, you can use that spectrum and offset it for selling commercial services in the general market. Is that kind of what this thing is sort of looking like here?
I think that's how it seems.
Not even right to the retail, but I mean, even a wholesale market.
That does seem to be the way that it's being pitched right now. They're, I believe, talking about the 3.1 to 3.55 band. It's 450 megahertz continuous spectrum. And I believe that they're looking at a wholesale approach, kind of like what you just mentioned. I'm not aware of any carriers that have built to that, so not exactly sure what the incentives would be for that actually being deployed, but that does seem to be where we are right now.
Hey, Kelly, you had something there?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, this is all sort of fuzzy around the edges right now. Nobody really knows exactly what is being proposed. Certainly, there are companies out there who are talking about a wholesale network. As you noted earlier, we all, or many of us, submitted responses to this request for information that DoD put out. Those responses were due on Monday. We've been told they will be made public, so I'm hopeful in the very near future we'll get a better idea of what it is exactly that's being proposed. But you know, right now it does sort of feel like we're shooting a little bit blind. But again, I'm hopeful we'll have some more detail to really dig into in the very near future.
Right. So to be clear, there's not a request for proposal out. It was just a request for information, correct?
That is true. We have certainly heard from a number of different parts of the federal government that even information that an RFP has actually already been drafted and they're just waiting to put it out. I mean, I say that with a little tongue in cheek here. You know, this whole city runs on rumors, but certainly the fact that the RFI came out with some very specific questions, we're taking this issue very seriously.
Okay, so then let's assume for the rest of the discussion then, because again, we don't know, but let's assume for the sake of discussion, which we're doing this, that essentially we're going to have and somebody's going to come in, arguably build a dedicated network for this, and essentially have the U.S. government give them for free 450 megahertz worth of spectrum. Right? Can we just sort of go that sort of as our base assumption? It may not be, you know, but I think that's what certainly the concern is, correct, Kelly, John?
Yes.
Okay.
You hit it on the head.
Okay. So let's proceed from that point. And by the way, to put that into perspective, 450 megahertz of spectrum, particularly of prime mid-band spectrum, is a lot of spectrum. I mean, the C-band was what, 2 280?
280.
280.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and even then people, I mean, you know, the AWS auction was what, 40? You know, I mean, I think it's really important to understand how much spectrum that is. And we'll sort of get also sort of the policy reasons. I'll get to Jordan a little bit that I've just been hearing sort of articulated on the news, and we can talk about it. All right, so let's start first. If we take that as our base assumption, let's talk about. I think I read CTIA's comments last night, and you guys bring up a host of very interesting legal issues that I hadn't thought about, but I think that bears discussing. In other words, this, from what I understand, and Kelly, please elaborate on this, you know, the government, the DOD just can't say, here you go, you can use this. There are certain laws in place that do that. So let's sort of go through that sort of in sequence that I found. So let's start with the first one, which is, I did not know this myself, there's an NTIA Organization Act, and apparently that precludes the DOD from conferring a right to commercial operation on federal spectrum without FCC authorization. Explain that a little bit, Kelly, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a series, and actually, let me put even a finer point on your earlier point about how much spectrum we're talking about. I mean, today in the United States, the commercial wireless industry has access to 70 megahertz of mid-band spectrum. And this is sort of the prime mid-band spectrum that you really need to build out a 5G network. And you compare that and contrast that to what's happening globally on mid-band spectrum. You know, China, Japan, South Korea are all making hundreds and hundreds of megahertz of mid-band spectrum available. So I really want to put a fine point on the fact that we're talking about literally the best 5G spectrum that's out there right now. And 450 megahertz is an enormous amount of spectrum. To answer your question, yes, there are, I think we've identified at least four different sort of legal impediments that would require the Department of Defense or the federal government to jump through some additional hoops in order to make something like this happen in the real world. And you're right, DOD can't just put out an RFP and sort of snap their fingers and say, okay, we're going to give 450 megahertz of spectrum to this one entity. There are Communications Acts requirements. Basically, if you're allowing the use of federal spectrum for a non-government application, you need to have an FCC license. And in order to get that license, you have to go through a competitive bidding through an auction process. That's how in this country we hand out spectrum licenses. We don't give them away. You actually have to go to the FCC and bid for those licenses in an auction. And I think, you know, what's brilliant about the way the U.S. has always gone about doling out spectrum licenses is, you know, it's one of the most valuable resources this country has is access to spectrum. And, you know, over the last, you know, however many years since the late 1990s, the U.S. government has brought over $100 billion into the Treasury from auctions for spectrum. So, you know, it's actually set up in this country to be a benefit to the U.S. government. Additionally, there's an argument that under the Miscellaneous Receipts Act, sort of a random act of Congress, that the DOD or the federal government writ large can't just take money from a private party without permission from Congress. So if they were to try to sort of lease access to their mid-band spectrum to a company to set up a wholesale network, that's something that would require congressional permission. Lastly, the Anti-Deficiency Act, sort of similarly, DOD isn't allowed to provide a benefit to a federal entity in exchange for any sort of consideration unless Congress specifically says they can do so. So, you know, Congress is going to have a big role to play in anything moving forward here, which is a good thing. There needs to be congressional involvement. You're talking about, again, very important federal asset in U.S. spectrum. And you're talking about sort of walking away from literally tens of billions of dollars that could benefit the federal government.
Well, we'll get to that in a little bit. I mean, it sounds to me, I mean, with these legal issues, I mean, I know that, you know, I guess it was about a year ago. I mean, you know, it sounds to me that given all these hurdles, if the DOD just decides to sort of rush ahead, we are going to be in litigation at the Federal Court of Claims over this for years. And this spectrum is not going to be put to commercial use at all for any reason. You know, you look at the JEDI contract that they had that, you know, people are fighting over that now. On a related topic, and Kelly, again, please jump in on this. Wasn't there a deal that was announced like couple months ago where part of this band that the FCC, I think it's like 100 megahertz, was going to auction it off? They had agreed to clear it and share it. So, you know, what's the interplay with that? And they did a notice of proposed rulemaking. What's the interplay with this? And then all of a sudden, wait a minute, we're going to do the whole band. Is it the same band? Is it a portion of the band? How does that affect each other?
Yeah, that's a great question. And like I said earlier, you know, the wireless industry is frankly scrambling right now to find more mid-band spectrum. And we were thrilled with the decision that was released in early August. DOD and White House through OSTP and other channels had been sitting down for months trying to hammer out a deal that would make 100 megahertz of spectrum between the 3.45 and 3.55 band available for auction at the end of next year. And that's a huge deal for our industry. Like I said, we are just desperate for more mid-band spectrum. So the presumption there is that spectrum would be auctioned and it would be cleared for full commercial, full power services, which is great. What's confusing to us right now is the way the RFI is drafted. It actually covers spectrum from 3.1 to 3.55. So presumably the way it's been drafted, it would actually cover or could cover that 100 megahertz that the White House and DOD just recently announced they wanted to auction. So right now we've sort of got two federal agencies moving in two sort of opposite directions. We've got the FCC moving forward with working towards auctioning that top 100 megahertz of spectrum, which is very important. But you've also got the DOD with this RFI sort of throwing out there the idea of, hey, we should look at utilizing 3.1 to 3.55. So, you know, at the end of the day, what the wireless industry and frankly any industry needs is predictability and sort of certainty when they're investing in building what are literally, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in network assets. So we would love to see some clarity here. And again, we're hoping at the end of this process that the DOD will actually say once and for all that the 3.45 to the 3.55 band should be auctioned by the FCC at the end of next year.
All right. Thank you. All right. John, do you have anything to add to that?
You know, I agree with pretty much all of what Kelly just said, and it's kind of important to keep in mind that we're doing this at a time when we're trying to win the race to 5G, and we're behind other countries with allocating mid-band. We've got a ton of millimeter wave, and that's great, but it's really not capable of doing the kind of things that we need in an indoor-outdoor environment. And if we're working against ourselves at a time when the Chinese are moving so quickly, it just puts us at a competitive disadvantage that doesn't make any sense.
All right, great. All right, well, with that, let's turn to the economic implications for a moment here with Dr. Ford. I would ask George to give a number on auction revenues, but George is always notorious because we don't know because it always depends on the terms of the auction. But we know that it's a lot of auction revenues. But I think the bigger issue here, again, going with the assumption that we've made that somehow that this is going to be the DOD wants a new network as opposed to having somebody who already has a network, but they want a new dedicated network, but essentially is going to get 450 megahertz of free mid-band spectrum that they can use for commercial purposes. How is that going to affect the industry structure? I think it's important, George and I, in disclosure, actually, we just did a FedSoc teleforum on this a couple weeks ago, just did a very large law review in the Federal Communications Law Journal entitled, appropriately, The Law and Economics of Municipal Broadband. Obviously, that's with local governments, but I think the themes are the same. And so what happens, you know, if you're getting a network that's getting a tremendous subsidy, in this case, it would be 450 megahertz of government spectrum. How would that play out in the industry in terms of competing against City Hall, George?
Well, it would depend on what the network is used for. I mean, if the DoD intends to use the network for itself and then allow people to encroach on the spectrum, but not the network, then that has one effect. Most likely that encroachment would be by existing providers, certainly given the certainty with how much you can access and when you can access. You'd have to have a spectrum that was yours and capable of addressing at least most of your traffic. If there's a network built and then that network is wholesale capacity is sold on that network to other providers, then you're essentially introducing potentially another firm or multiple firms into the market. And as we've seen recently with the merger of Sprint and T-Mobile, probably in a situation in this country of an equilibrium of three mobile wireless firms. I know that Dish is said it intends to build its own network. We're still kind of waiting to see how that plays out. But that could certainly interfere with Dish's ability or willingness to construct its own mobile wireless network to be a fourth major national player.
And in this case, if it, you know, but you're talking, it's not even the subsidy can't be replicated here. It's spectrum. If this firm uses it, you can't. Nobody. It's not like we're making any more.
Well, I mean, it just depends on the model that they develop. I mean, if they build a network for themselves, a private network for themselves, and just tell people, okay, you can encroach, you know, when we're not using it or in areas where we don't use it a lot, that's one scenario that would affect the market in one way. But to build a what people describe as a wholesale network where somebody could come in, Walmart or whoever, and say, okay, I'm going to sell a service on the DoD's network, then that's a different scenario. I don't see how the second one plays out. I mean, this doesn't seem even plausible for the DoD to build a network capable of serving, you know, a huge quantity of retail customers with spectrum they're not all that sure is going to be available to those customers. If the DoD needs it, it'd certainly take the preemptive. So that model doesn't make any sense to me. The sensible model between the two would be you can have access to the spectrum. But right now, we have no idea what they're really intending to do. Is DoD building a network for DoD only, or is DoD building a network that people can share? I mean, I think that'd just be a disaster.
Well, that seems to be from what the press reports are talking about. And let me follow up with that, George. You know, going to what you just said a moment ago, you know, DoD wants to build this network. Arguably, it doesn't want to give up the spectrum, and it wants to maintain all of its spectrum. Because, I mean, this has been a fight with the government, getting the government to pry its hands off spectrum for years. They may not be using it. It's just on that one time when, you know, they need it. We need it now, so we're just going to hoard it forever. And that's been a problem for years with getting access to government spectrum. And, you know, we wrote a paper a couple of years ago. When we started, our thought was, you know, we need a paper that says government uses spectrum inefficiently. And then we end up finding all these quotes from the government admitting they use spectrum inefficiently. It's like, well, so much for that paper. But we realized it was sort of the use and management of the spectrum. So, I mean, I guess the question is that, you know, if the DOD really wants a dedicated network for national security purposes, would there be a more efficient way of doing this than putting 450 megahertz of spectrum? I mean, I just saw a press report the other day that the Army announced that they're going to use FirstNet. So, I mean, it's capable of doing this. Why put all of that spectrum into one entity? It just seems that you're just a huge band.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that the Department of Defense would need that much spectrum to conduct its operations. It certainly may want some privacy in its network, but I feel confident that private providers can provide that service through some kind of model like FirstNet. The spectrum is actually given to private companies in some kind of agreement about how to use it. I really think when I look at this, I mean, the thing about this, when you're so vague, people can come up with all kinds of models, and some people are more attuned to what's going on behind the veil at the White House and places like that, the Department of Defense. When I looked at this, I thought, well, particularly because they mentioned the 100 megahertz are supposed to be giving the private sector for auction, is that what the DOD wants to do is not give away its spectrum. And one way you do that is you build a network on it and then say, oh, well, you can't take it away. I got a network operating on this. Of course, they don't need 350, 450 megahertz of spectrum. Say, oh, well, we built this network and we have all these other people using it. So they should be happy because they get access to it. To me, it's just a preemptive play to block the taking of more of this extremely valuable spectrum from them. And then however you want to dress it up past that is sort of certainly legitimate given the vagueness of the proposal. But to me, it just looks like a preemption by the DOJ to protect its spectrum assets and keep them from being taken and auctioned.
All right. Well, let me ask you two more questions as long as I have you. I mean, I guess it was about a year ago I was watching a business channel on cable, and they had Newt Gingrich on. And I made this point actually at a FedSoc panel I did about a month ago, told the story. And Newt got up, and who has been a big advocate of this national 5G, you know, race to 5G stuff. And in full disclosure, I've always found that argument a bit skeptical because it's not like I can go to the mall and go buy China Telecom service. I'm not racing against anybody. But it's been a good motivator to get a lot of things done, like tower sightings and so forth and so on. You know, everybody needs a slogan. But as I think we've seen in this case, sometimes that slogan can backfire. So I'm watching Newt, and Newt's going, this is great. If we have a national 5G network, this is going to fundamentally change the economics of the business and drive Huawei out of business. And that's why we need a fund, you know, and it's going to be 100% coverage. I've been doing this business a long time. Is this going to change the economics of the business, or are the economics going to dictate the business and we're not going to be happy with the results, George?
Economics will dictate.
Exactly.
And I don't think that the description of the DOD network, a nationalized network run by the government, I think that's just a disastrous idea. I'm still not confident that that's really what's being proposed. But I think on the race to 5G, it seems to me that a key underlying element that's rarely mentioned is the equipment issue and the Huawei issue. And that is, can the government somehow enter the business, buy a bunch of gear from some company other than Huawei to create scale economies for another equipment vendor? And then that would help build an alternative through essentially what would be a subsidy from the government. That's a possibility. But I think everybody's legitimate in their concern that this thing would – I mean, if it's described as a DOD building and operating a national 5G network, you know, it's going to be a financial disaster and probably a technology disaster too. They just don't have the mindset are the skills that are required to build and operate and maintain these sophisticated networks that require massive injections of cash. You know, every 3 or 4 years, you got to build to an entirely new standard. I mean, we talk about building a 5G network. We're already talking about building a 6G network. And what are they going to do then? Where's the money going to come from then to massively upgrade that network and then deal with all the customers and all that? I mean, it's just not even plausible that the government could run a nationwide 5G network. But again, it just depends on what the DoD is really thinking about doing. And I also think when you talk about a company like Rivad, I mean, Rivad has been looking for a platform to try its spectrum sharing. Been looking for that for years now, decades probably, and they haven't found it yet. And, you know, they're thinking, well, this might be the sort of opportunity that would allow me to try this out where the private sector is really not interested in that model. But if, you know, if the private sector isn't interested in your model, typically what you do is you run to the government, find some non-economic actor that'll take on a risk nobody else would bother with. So, I mean, there's a lot of strategy going on here, I think, but not a whole lot of thinking and certainly not a whole lot of clarity.
Well, that brings me to sort of the next set of questions I have for everybody, because that was a good lead in, because as everybody knows, we are in the heart of the political season. There's an election coming up. There's a battle for the soul of the country. And when it comes to broadband, it's magical, and that is people actually run on that issue. And when things become political, they tend to be less substantive, and sometimes we get good outcomes. More often than not, we have bad outcomes. So this is particularly to Kelly and to John. I mean, so what's been the response on the Hill about this? If you sort of go through, I know Senator Thune's written a letter and you talk about that. You know, what do the Democrats think? I mean, where are we with this? Because, again, the promise, both parties are promising ubiquitous broadband as part of their platforms now, notwithstanding the cost of serving 100%. But let's put that aside for the moment. What's the environment now on Capitol Hill? And Kelly, I'll start with you.
I've been really pleased to see the reaction on Capitol Hill has been really, from what I've seen, uniform disagreement with this idea. You noted Senator Thune led a fantastic letter that went up to President Trump, signed by 18 of his Republican colleagues, including Senator Blackburn. Chairman Pallone and Chairman Doyle of the House Energy and Commerce Committee recently sent a letter asking a series of questions about how this all came about, what this is really going to do, and asked some really pointed questions there. Chairman Wicker of the Senate Commerce Committee and Ranking Member Walden of the House Energy and Commerce Committee recently introduced legislation that would require the auction of the 3.45 to the 3.55 band, which is a great step forward. So, you know, and I expect there to be additional letters and additional statements. Doris Matsui, Congresswoman Matsui, just put out a statement yesterday denouncing this idea. So it's really been a bipartisan denouncement, which has been great. There's not too many things right now that are bipartisan on the Hill, but this is definitely one of them. And I expect that to continue to go forward over the next few months.
John, I read a news report. There's a thing, apparently there's a thing called the Beat China for 5G Act. What is that?
You know, I'm actually not familiar with that particular legislation. I know we've introduced a whole lot of similar bills that are just kind of looking at what. Sorry, do you have something?
There, John.
That's actually the bill that I referenced. The 3.45.
Okay. Okay. So, what exactly would that bill do, Kelly?
So, it basically requires the FCC to auction that spectrum, which again is what was decided between the DoD and the White House in early August. That's when it was announced that they would clear this 100 megahertz of spectrum and auction it off at the end. I think December 2021 was the date that they were looking to do that.
Right. I mean, I have to imagine, I mean, particularly after, you know, what we went through with the C-band, where Senator Kennedy got on the floor And it is true, I've never seen this, but I like repeating this on a FedSoc, where he actually said, you know, he was upset with the hype over 5G, quote, it can solve erectile dysfunction, close quote. And that is a true quote, I can say that. But, you know, the whole thing is that, you know, you're not going to let that go with that kind of money. People just went up in arms about it. And to think that people, you know, that politicians who want to fund a whole bunch of things would let that, the possibility of even getting a, you know, even auctioning off some was just strikes me as this is a political non-starter. But let me ask you this question, and this is sort of thinking a couple steps down the road, because I've just been reading a lot about this. I mean, one of the things that always works in this town, although not necessarily apparent at the time, but there's always sort of a precedential value, you know, a couple steps down the road. One of the things I think, which is why certainly people on the conservative side are getting very upset, is that, you know, again, I've seen a lot of articles, you know, this is municipal broadband. I don't think it is, but it's similar too. But if we go back and we see what the Democrats had wanted, you know, going all the way back to 2008, you know, a single national network, we've seen this. Does this, in a bizarre way, if this goes through, create a very bad precedent for just municipal broadband all over the place? And I don't think you can discount that. You know, John, what do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that you're right to point out that the themes here are pretty similar. The reason the government isn't good at creating broadband networks on the municipal side for wireline is the same for wireless. And these carriers have spent billions of dollars developing this technology over decades. 5G didn't appear out of thin air. This has been an iterative process. So, you know, thinking that you can just prop up this 5G network with nothing else underneath it seems a little short-sighted to me.
I mean, legislatively, I mean, what would you think would be Congress's preferred solution to, you know, if DOD really does need its, you know, they want a dedicated network? I mean, do you guys sort of buy the argument, or are people going, well, how can we solve this problem and give you what you need without going down this path?
So from a legislative standpoint, we could draft something that would say, here's the section of this band that you're going to have that's going to be totally dedicated to you. Here are the appropriate guard bands. And then we can auction off another portion of the band. We need spectrum for deficit reduction. That's something that has been, you know, very well applauded throughout the Congress. And it would be strange to be able to create this other precedent that we can just start giving away one of our most valuable resources.
Right. I mean, we've been trying to clear this forever. And it does seem odd, sort of through the mechanism of this. But again, we don't exactly know. We're all doing, as Kelly said, on rumors. Well, we've been going for about 45 minutes already, and I know that we've covered all the topics that I want to cover. So if there are any questions from our audience, we would love to entertain them.
We'll now go to our first caller.
Hey guys, it's Seton Motley. I came in a little tardy. I apologize. I was on a radio show. But my question is, do we know the latest from the – I've heard you guys mention it a couple times, the White House. Do we – you know, Larry Kudlow's been very vocal against this. Trump said no a couple times. Former Secretary – White Press Secretary Sanders said no. Where are they now? Have they vacillated? I mean, do we know if the Pentagon is working at odds with the White House and the SEC, or just the SEC?
It does seem like there's some internal division. I think there is some internal division within the White House right now that's on this. They're not uniform on where they want to go, from what it sounds like. Kelly, you can take it.
I was just going to say, I mean, honestly, there has been no better White House for 5G than the Trump administration. I mean, it's really been phenomenal what Trump's been able to accomplish over the almost 4 years that he's been in office. I mean, the FCC has made spectrum available. They've removed red tape for siting of new 5G infrastructure. He hosted a 5G summit and basically sort of endorsed this whole idea that 5G networks in this country should be built by through competition and the free market. So, I mean, honestly, we were pretty surprised when we started to hear that this RFI was rumbling around DOD. And, You know, I mean, we've always known that there are elements, frankly, in the White House and at DOD that are interested in this idea. And, you know, there's some powerful advocates pushing it that are downtown. So, you know, I think it's fair to say we're taking this very seriously. And while we have an RFI today, you know, I would not be surprised to see this turn into an RFP. But again, we're doing everything we can to educate folks about the problems that this kind of a network would entail. I mean, we talked a little bit about sort of, you know, the obstacles of DOD managing its own network. You know, they've got enough on their plate fighting wars around the country. I sort of leave them to that. But, you know, this has been tried in other countries. This has been tried in Russia. This has been tried in Mexico, Belarus, Rwanda. A bunch of different countries have tried this, and they've all failed miserably. So I don't know why we would, based on those examples, invest the money and the time and the resources that it's going to be necessary to try to get something like this up and running, when at the end of the day, these examples just routinely fail.
Kelly, just to jump in on that, I mean, as we all know, over the last couple months, again, you know, this notion that broadband, everybody needs broadband, you know, all the way to the hinterlands of, you know, the middle of Function Junction, Montana, you know, where nobody lives. But, you know, there's this push. I mean, is that really sort of the pitch here, that they think that, you know, this will finally solve the homework gap? I mean, is this what people are sort of playing on, which is why people are pushing that, you know, we're promising broadband no matter what?
Yes, and that's a great point. And, you know, I think for all the right reasons, Congress and the administration is very focused on how do we make sure we get rural broadband to America, and especially, you know, in the COVID era. It's a legitimate and it's an important question. But if your goal is to really fix the wireless problem, this doesn't get you to that solution. Because really, you'd be, number one, you're starting from scratch, right? There's no credible way to catch up with what the national carriers are already doing. We already have three national 5G networks. 250 million people today are already covered with 5G. You've also got, you know, T-Mobile recently merged with Sprint, and they actually made some very hard and fast commitments about building out 5G around the country. They are required to serve 97% of all Americans in 3 years and 99% in 6 years. So, you know, the government shouldn't step in and try to fix something that the free market is already providing. So, you know, that would be my biggest point is, you know, to the extent that we do have rural broadband issues, this will not solve it. And there are ways that the FCC is looking at getting at those issues, like, for instance, the 5G fund, which, you know, they're taking a really hard look at. So, yes, we need to solve the rural broadband problem. This is not how you do it.
Gotcha. Thank you. Okay. Next question, if we have one.
Indeed, we do.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick here in D.C. Two-part question real quick. Have the Democrats in their platform or whatever taken any position about this? And secondly, who's going to be, assuming that Biden wins, who are going to be the point people for the Democrats on these issues?
I'm an academic, so I don't know these things. But Kelly, you're our Washington expert, so whatever you can do. I mean, I think the Democratic platform, again, you can just read it. They're that's why I brought up the municipal broadband question. They're very much in favor of it, and in fact, in the Infrastructure Act that they passed a couple months ago, again, and I would commend you to listen to our podcast on our Law and Economics of Municipal Broadband paper that we did for the FedSoc last month. A very sweeping preemption issue in terms of who's going to go in. And Kelly, you may want to jump in, but I would offer this caveat. You never know till people get there, and let's get through the election first. But Kelly, you're welcome to join in on this.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I do think the people that are going to be looking at this issue and a potential Biden administration probably would be much different than the folks who are looking at it now in a Trump administration. So obviously the FCC is going to be really important. So who the chairman of the FCC under a Biden administration is going to be very important. DOD, obviously, whoever is the Secretary of Defense is going to be a point person here as well. I will say, there's one individual that's been very active in Democrat circles on this issue, and it's been Eric Schmidt, who's the former chairman of Google. He's been doing a lot of meetings, both with DOD and on the Hill and the White House, talking to folks, trying to influence the creation of, you know, this nationalized network utilizing DOD spectrum. So, you know, I do think there are some very well-heeled interests that are pushing this, both not just on the Republican side, but also on the Democrat side.
Yeah, those kind of rents at stake, you get a lot of friends in Washington.
Yeah, lots of money at stake, absolutely.
Exactly. All right, thank you. Next question, please.
We have two callers in the queue. Let's go to the first one now.
Hi, it's Mike Rollins. Thanks for hosting this call. Just kind of curious to delve a little bit more into what you've learned about how the DOD could use a government-owned network. So, you know, in your discussions around this, have there been specific examples of if this network was created, the DOD could do, you know, X or Y with that network?
Kelly, again, I'll throw that to you, then to George. And by the way, hi, Mike. It's good to hear from you.
I'm not aware of anything specifically. I mean, it's interesting because actually the DOD has been actively involved in putting out, there were RFPs recently just announced, the winners were announced, to put together five test sites around the country, and they announced $600 million in awards. These are 5G test beds that they're doing on five different bases around the country. And I think what is great about this kind of example is they are actually partnering with, you know, existing wireless carriers to figure out how to best deploy on bases and sort of utilizing different technologies on different bases to see what works best. And, you know, I think fair to say, you know, certainly AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, they all today do an enormous amount of work partnering with DOD. And, you know, what we've always said to DOD is, you know, let us help you. You know, frankly, our U.S. carriers are so far advanced on 5G. Certainly, I would argue much farther advanced than DOD is on the 5G issue that, you know, help, let us help you utilize our platforms so you can get the most out of what it is you need to do, whether it be war fighting or AI or 5G, whatever it may be, you know, let us collaborate with you. And so, you know, we've really tried to stress the cooperative nature of what that relationship should be. There's no real need for DOD to build its own network when you've already got three national networks out there and they could utilize those networks to do anything that DOD needs to do.
All right.
You go to our next caller or George?
Yeah, I think that covers it. I think that's probably a legal issue than an economic one.
We'll go to our next caller now.
Hi, it's Tricia Paoletta from Paris, Wilson, Granis. Hello, everybody.
Hi,
nice to hear you all. Hello. I was worried this was going to be a little too wonky in the weeds, but Kelly teed it up already because it did occur to me that there's a tension between, right, with the test beds they've just done and the, you know, 5G test beds, you know, which is in 3.1 to 3.55, right? This mid-band spectrum, which is the global harmonized band, you know, for 5G. So critical to winning that race. But what's in there now, right, in 3.1, 3.55, you know, is largely radar and other, you know, other systems. I mean, that struck me as so strange. If they, how can they hope to share enough spectrum, you know, and we know 5G needs big, huge, contiguous blocks, 100 megahertz, 200 megahertz to really fulfill its promise. How can they hope to share that spectrum to actually even deliver 5G, unless, you know, they really don't need that much spectrum from radar and they could squeeze down the band. So, I mean, you know, I'm interested in hearing just your impression on that. Kelly, John, you know, George, you've got insight there. And of course, a reminder that their RFI is not limited to the 3 gigahertz band, right? It's everywhere. So they, you know, and to the extent, well, we're going to need more spectrum in the pipeline for 6G as well. You know, the threat is beyond just the 3 gigahertz. But anyway, threw a lot out there. But I just, if you've got a sense of whether they're thinking of moving their radar in other bands so they can, you know, monetize their juicy spectrum, I'd just like to hear that.
Thanks. Thanks, Trish. And Kelly, again, I'm going to throw it over to you on this one.
Yeah, no, and that's a fantastic question, and one, frankly, I've been asking a lot. You know, while the 3.45 to 3.55 band was being negotiated between the White House and DOD, you know, honestly, we want more access than 100 megahertz. So, you know, I remember having these questions with both sides of that negotiating team and basically saying, look, 100 megahertz is great. Could we do 200? And the answer every time back to us was there are mission critical radar systems in that lower part of the 3 gigahertz band, and we just can't do it. So, you know, it's interesting a few months later that we're kind of getting the different answer. But, you know, what's there today, classified and unclassified, you've got Air Force, high power airborne radar systems that, as I understand it, provide early warning and control functions for DOD. So, you know, I certainly, as much as we need spectrum, you know, I will be fair here and say, you know, what the U.S. military does is very important, and we want to make sure that they have the spectrum to do what they need to do. But we also want to make sure that they're using that spectrum as efficiently as possible. And certainly, you know, we did a study at CTIA on this recently, looking at the efficiency of our networks. And they're crazy efficient when you compare them to how the government, whether it's DOD or any other federal agency, is utilizing their spectrum. So I think, and I, you know, Senator Blackburn's talked about this too, is how do we create incentives that push the federal government to use those spectrum assets as efficiently as possible. And if they can move those radar systems down in the band and make additional assets available, that would be fantastic. And, you know, we're not against wholesale networks. You know, anybody could go to an FCC auction and buy the spectrum to set up a wholesale network. So, you know, we want to make sure that that spectrum is being used as efficiently and effectively as possible.
All right, John and George, got anything on this?
Yeah, so I think with respect to warfighting capabilities, what DOD is thinking about, you know, part of it is we're going to figure out how to develop things on 5G, and that's where we're doing the testbed program. But part of it is how do we exist in contested electromagnetic spectrum environments, and some of this stuff is, you know, out in the ocean. So to the extent they're able to do something with other carriers within the United States, you know, that's something that's beneficial. And, you know, if we're able to negotiate other deals where they can share spectrum and have preemptive capabilities to be able to do what they need, those are things that we're all interested in looking in. The more that we're able to have a productive dialogue, I think better off we're going to be. So hopefully we get to a point where we're not always just talking about nationalization.
All right, George, you got anything or no?
Hey, this is George. I'm sorry I got dropped off there. Yeah, I mean,
George, you're back on.
We did a big paper on how to best manage spectrum resources years ago. I just don't think that the government has the proper skill set or the proper incentives to manage spectrum resources properly. That's a very detailed study if anybody wants to read it. So I think that when you've got a large chunk of spectrum here, the DOD is using it. They perform vital services for the nation. There's no question about that. But it may be possible to transfer those resources elsewhere to get a more efficient use of them. And really, I think to transfer all spectrum that's used by the government to some sort of private sector management organization would do a lot to help migrate the spectrum more efficiently going forward. I mean, there's the efficient use of spectrum from a technical perspective, and there's also the efficient management of spectrum. And they're really two different things. And I think that both need to be discussed. We don't do it very often. NTIA did a big study years ago, cited in our paper, but we cover that topic at length. But I think that's something that might ought to be on the table is, and I guess NTIA is supposed to. I don't know if they do a very good job of it. Probably not. But how to better manage and assign the rights that the government entities certainly need, but to create incentives within the government for efficient use, which granted is going to be incredibly difficult. Efficiency is not the government's strong suit.
I think we have time for one more question, if we do have one more question in the queue.
Indeed, we do. Let's go to them now.
Yes, thanks so much. This may be the dumbest question of the day, so I apologize in advance. Limited exposure to telecommunications law, and would love to expose myself to read the papers that you alluded to, but with respect to DOD's use of the spectrum, I think probably it's not so much DOD itself. It's probably, you know, somewhat lazy DOD contractors. I think most of those technical determinations are probably made by, you know, beltway bandits of the, I won't besmirch particular companies, but defense contractors. And I'm wondering to what extent, you know, exposing them and or DOD itself to the auction process, along with the appropriate technical studies, is part of the solution to this Gordian knot. I don't think the uniform side necessarily has a whole lot of the appropriate expertise on this.
Anyone take that question?
Well, I would start by saying there are no dumb questions when it comes to spectrum. most eyes glaze over when you start having conversations about spectrum policy. So I appreciate you even tuning in. I think because this whole concept, you know, and Larry mentioned this a little earlier, that this really is what I would consider a spectrum giveaway. You've got a lot of different organizations, for-profit, not-for-profit. Everybody's got an opinion on this. And, you know, there's literally tens of billions of dollars of spectrum at stake here. So whether it be defense contractors or other, you know, companies that are willing to take advantage of this, you know, if you set up a system where you don't have to go to a sanctioned FCC auction to buy spectrum, you are just creating just economic havoc. U.S. wireless carriers have spent well over, I think at this point, $120 billion on spectrum assets. And, you know, the great thing about that is it doesn't just help sort of U.S. taxpayer, but, you know, it helps us win these kinds of races to 5G. You know, we're reinvesting those monies into our country, and there's a huge benefit to that. So I'm not sure I really answered your question necessarily, but, you know, I think the benefit of adhering to what has been spectrum policy in this country since the late 1990s, we should stick to what works, and this does work.
And Kelly, it just occurred to me after listening to this. I mean, one of the things we didn't bring up, but for those people on the call who are not intimately familiar with the way, you know, we do spectrum allocation, this isn't the same thing as, say, you know, the way we allocate, for example, spectrum for unlicensed use, where it's sort of a spectrum commons. This is actually spectrum which would be dedicated for this that somebody would have control over. This isn't just going to be open to everybody. And I think that's a really important point to sort of add on top of all of this. In case people had sort of missed that. I mean, it's a very, very different situation here. So we are now...
The value of licensed spectrum like this is it's so valuable because, to your point, you can control it. And what it provides, you know, wireless companies is the ability to, like I said earlier, predictability and certainty. And you know when your customer places a call or goes on the internet, those searches are going to be resolved. So, you know, I think the danger why we don't build networks with unlicensed spectrum is the risk of interference. And, you know, you can't sell a product to a consumer and expect them to have it work half the time. It has to work all the time. When somebody makes a 911 call, it has to go through. So, you know, the importance of this concept of commercially licensed spectrum is really, really important to our wireless economy.
All right. Well,
I got one more thing, Larry, on that.
Oh, please, George.
You see this across the board in broadband, mainly because people get kind of goofy when they think about broadband. But, you know, the government, when you want the government to do something, first of all, it's got to be really important that it get done. And second, nobody else is willing to do it. And third, you're willing to have it done poorly, okay? Because the government's going to do it poorly. It's just their nature. But some things are so important that you're willing to have them done poorly. But if somebody else is willing to do it, then there's not a very good argument for government to do it. And we certainly don't have a lack of investment in mobile wireless networks in this country. We have very experienced providers who use their spectrum very efficiently, invest billions every year to improve and maintain their networks. So there's just really no case that I can see for a government-run mobile wireless network. But then again, I'm not exactly sure that's what's being proposed here. If the DoD wants its own private network, that's one thing. But even then, I think it would be much better. I'm sure almost all their communications services that are provided today are probably provided by somebody other than themselves. So I just don't really see what the argument for a government built and operated network is in the mobile wireless space.
Well, John, you have any last thoughts here, real quick?
Yeah, you know, just real quickly, to the question on whether DoD's kind of thought through where their inventory is, it's something we actually worked with the Commerce and Armed Services Committees, not just for DoD, but the federal government in general. It would be helpful for us to be able to get more of an inventory of where their spectrum assets are. So, you know, it's a work in progress, but there are a lot of more technical things that are kind of underlying why it's taking so long to get there.
Well, like I said, we're actually running long, but I want to thank all of our guests today, John Adam, Kelly Cole from CTIA, Dr. George Ford from the Phoenix Center. This was a truly excellent discussion. I'm glad that you all find value from your FedSoc membership, but this was really a fantastic in-depth policy-oriented discussion. I hope everybody enjoyed themselves. And my name is Larry Spiwak. You can check out our work at the Phoenix Center, www.phoenix-center.org. And so with that, I thank everybody for tuning in and spending some time with us today. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.